According to radical empiricism, the experience data of our lives do not form a perfect unity. Remember, the primal stuff is pure experience, but experience is not all unified. And so James held to what's called metaphysical pluralism. There's not a perfect unity in the data of pure experience. He also maintained that indeterminism is characteristic of the natural world. There's novelty or freedom. To get back to Peirce, the world is characterized by chance. However, the natural world, the chance world, is evolving toward ultimate unification, though that will never be fully achieved. That is the direction of history and nature. Now, if you think that the primal stuff of reality is pure experience, then it will not surprise you that William James is known for the stream of consciousness school of psychology. That's what reality is. It's just a stream of experience, a stream of consciousness. But you can never unify it all together. We'll never get to a final, fully achieved unification of all of our experiences. Well, how do you decide what kind of philosophy to follow, what kind of religion to follow, if you're a pragmatist of the William James sort? Remember, Charles Peirce would not necessarily like this. In fact, this is what made him very uncomfortable. Peirce wanted to be more scientific. James, being a psychologist, is more interested in the stream of consciousness and kind of soft or subjective internal considerations and experience. According to William James, the philosophy that you follow is determined by your temperament, the kind of person you are, your general emotional outlook and perspective. Your temperament determines your philosophy. And he said there are really two kinds of philosophy. There are those philosophies which are rational, intellectual, and dogmatic, but there are also philosophies which are more empirical, material, and skeptical. So if you're oriented toward look and see as a way of determining what to believe, look and see, and being skeptical, wanting to reconsider, trying to stay close to the material world, then you'll be one kind of philosopher. If your approach is more dogmatic, intellectualistic, looking for a rational system, you'll be a different kind of philosopher. Now, I like and I dislike this observation. What do I like about it? Well, if you've been one of my students throughout this sequence in the history of philosophy, you know that I believe that's true. We have these two different kinds of orientation. In the first class in the sequence, I said you can understand the pre-Socratic philosophers and then finally Plato and Aristotle on the basis of whether their approach to philosophy was a look and see or a stop and think. There are some philosophers who say we need to stop and reflect on things. We need to get rationally clear about things. And there are other philosophers who say if you want to know what the world is, look and see. Get out of your armchair, go out and experience the world. Now, this is broad and probably over general, but it does, again, give you poles in terms of a mentality. Plato was a stop and think kind of philosopher. You got to reflect on this and make sure you can make rational sense out of what you're saying. Aristotle was more the kind of person who said, go out and experience the world. Get in touch with the particulars of nature. What's it like out there? Poor Plato, sitting back home in his armchair, speculating about ideas and ideals and forms that exist outside this world. Little does he know, if he'd open his eyes and look at the world, he'd say, everything's in change. Everything's in process here. And so they really had a different approach. So I like William James' observation that there are different orientations to philosophy. What I dislike is that he makes it a matter of temperament. It's as though, you know, we're all just subject to our psychological makeup. You know, some people have this kind of personality, some that. You're a more Platonic personality. You're a more Aristotelian personality, something like that. I would say it has a lot more to do with your presuppositions, your cultural context, your approach to life, than just your psychological makeup. And now what about religion? His views on religion were controversial. According to him, we have a right to believe in God because it enriches our lives. Now that fits into pragmatism, doesn't it? If believing in God has good, fruitful, practical consequences, then you have a right to believe. Because of the distinction between productive and transmissive functions of the brain, this is a psychologist talking, productive functions set over against transmissive functions of the brain, William James held that immortality is possible. He looked upon religion as the most important function of man because it's what gives value and zest to life. Religion is where we find our ideals. In religion and ethics, man is sometimes free to decide which of various conflicting hypotheses to accept them if the choice is of vital concern to him and he cannot rationally settle a question. If it's a vital concern, that is, it gives zest to life, gives value to him. If it cannot be rationally resolved, then he has a right to believe according to his inclination. Now you can imagine what kind of controversy that fomented among people who were critical of religion. Basically, what William James was saying is, I don't have to answer to your philosophical problems or even your scientific, empirical, historical attacks on religion. It's not really a question of whether you can rationally prove that God exists or not. That'll be a matter of your temperament. Some people think you can, some people think you can't. It's not rationally decidable. And where it is not rationally decidable, if it has a major impact on your life, hey, he's a pragmatist. He says you have a pragmatic justification for believing. So the will to believe, that the title of that book, is characteristic of James' pragmatic approach to religious matters as well. And then one last remark about his view of religion, and that's that once again, because of evil in the world, William James said, God must be finite. God is not able to overcome the evil that is in the world, and so he must be a finite God. Now, this is the third time you've heard this view, and I'll leave it to you to go back and put the other ones together. Looks like a good exam question to me. Expound on those who held to the view that God must be finite, and why did they hold to that? William James would be one of the people you mentioned. Okay, was there a question? No, I haven't made much of an attempt to explain it. I wanted you to get these words down there. You can reflect on it. The brain has various functions. Some of them are productive, but other functions of the brain are transmissive. They pass one thing on to another. And based on that psychological examination, he could think of the brain transmitting personality or life or certain things beyond death. I didn't tell you it was a good argument, but he said that when we see that in life, that the brain has transmissive possibilities, then it's at least possible that there is a life, a personality that survives the death of the body. Immortality is possible given the various functions of the brain that we see even now. Yes, Jay. No, he was a neutral monist, remember? As I said, he didn't believe that matter or mind were real in and of themselves. There is a neutral primal stuff, which is what? Experience, consciousness. So no, he is not necessarily a materialist or a mentalist. And he did believe in the possibility of immortality, so I think I'd have to say no. He's not a materialist. Right. Okay, any other questions about Charles Peirce, William James? Okay, then we're going to come to the pragmatist that I want to give the most attention to because I think he's the most important in terms of cultural influence, and that's John Dewey. Go ahead, you have a remark. Well, I said this is anti-intellectual. He didn't, but go ahead. Not so that he could understand. He wasn't saying, look, I'm an intellectual midget, please talk in small words for me. No, what he was saying is, all of this other stuff doesn't matter. All of the intellectual contrivances and the systems of thought, the only thing we are interested in is their cash value. So that's what he was saying. Now, before you think you're giving a substantial criticism of James, you have to understand that he might very well appreciate that remark. Now, he also would, I think, say he has a good defense, but he'd say you're asking the right question. Is it really practical to try to express your theory when you call it radical empiricism? But what you're asking here is that the best way to communicate what I want to get across to people? Does it have pragmatic value to call it radical empiricism? And I would say, among other people, that's a very good way to capture what he's trying to say. He wants to take a, you know, look and see approach to what we know and be radical about it. I want to push it to the limit. Okay, John Dewey now. Dewey's dates are 1859 to 1952. Dewey is an American philosopher, perhaps one of the best-known American philosophers of the 20th century. He was also a psychologist and an educator, or at least an educational theorist. He had teaching stints at the University of Michigan, Minnesota, and Chicago, and eventually became professor of philosophy at Columbia University. The leading exponent of pragmatism in the 20th century, although he started his academic career, or at least his student years, as a Hegelian. He was influenced by the writings of William James. And you know the rest of the story, became a pragmatist. Although Dewey preferred to call his philosophical outlook instrumentalism. What really matters in our thinking and decisions is the instrumental value, whether what we believe, what we say, is an instrument to accomplishing things. In 1910, he published the book How We Think. In 1916, Essays in Experimental Logic. In 1920, Reconstruction in Philosophy. In 1925, Experience in Nature. In 1929, The Quest for Certainty. 1937, The Teacher and Society. And the last one I'll mention, and I'm being selective, 1939, Logic, the Theory of Inquiry. Logic, the Theory of Inquiry. Now, once again, we have a series of books published by the author where, if you'll stop and reflect on the titles, you get a pretty good idea of what his philosophy is. He wants to know the nature of thinking. Logic is seen in an experimental fashion. He believes philosophy needs to be reconstructed, turned around. What's important about nature is our experience of it and how we relate to it. He has, this is central, I think. I've written an essay that deals with this. He thinks that the question about certainty, the quest for certainty, has got to be reoriented to practical certainty away from intellectual certainty. The views of Dewey are very influential in American education theory. And then this last one, logic, the theory of inquiry, that's what it's all about, inquiry. That's what education is, learning to develop your powers of inquiry. What the pragmatist says about truth and nature is we need to inquire, we need to experiment, we need to find out what is instrumentally valuable for us. Dewey brought together the views of Charles Peirce and William James, and he made pragmatism a theory which had equally logical and ethical applications. Pragmatism is a view of thinking, logic, how we find the truth or what it means to find the truth. But also, pragmatism is an orientation toward life, telling us how we should relate to others, to society. And so it has both logical and ethical applications. In the quest for certainty, Dewey rejected what he called the spectator theory of knowledge. It would be good for you to write that down. That's a very helpful summation of Dewey's attitude. He said, philosophy shouldn't be a matter of being a spectator like at a sporting event. Theories of knowledge that say we are back here and we are looking at the world, we're spectators on it, trying to perceive what is true, he said, have to be rejected. What's important is not what man believes as a spectator, but what man experiences and how he solves his problems. What modern men should be doing then is not trying to come up with these abstract philosophical answers about the nature of reality and man and nature and so forth, but men should rather learn to modify nature to be an active, involved agent in nature rather than simply a passive subject of nature. And so the rejection of the spectator approach to the theory of knowledge in favor of an activistic go out and change nature, so that certainty is not intellectual, certainty is practical. The only certainty you need and should be pursuing is how to solve problems. I'd like to give you a quote that would be worth writing down. He said, philosophy recovers itself when it ceases to be a device for dealing with the problems of philosophers. There's more, but let me repeat that much of it. Philosophy recovers itself when it ceases to be a device for dealing with the problems of philosophers and becomes a method, cultivated by philosophers for dealing with the problems of men. Well, that puts it well. Becomes a method cultivated by philosophers for dealing with the problems of men. So let's put it all together. Philosophy recovers itself when it ceases to be a device for dealing with the problems of philosophers and becomes a method cultivated by philosophers for dealing with the problems of men. Or if I can give you the Dr. Bahnsen three-word summary, philosophy is reorienting philosophy, having a new approach to certainty, is amount to making philosophy not deal with the intellectualistic questions of the philosophers, but looking at what men in general need to have done and giving them a method for solving their problems. Philosophers can help cultivate that method, refine it, correct it. So this is a nice nugget for capturing what Dewey was all about. Philosophy is a method cultivated by philosophers for dealing with the problems of men. What influences might we note on the pragmatism of Dewey? Well, three come to my mind. First of all, Darwinism. Dewey was an out-and-out advocate of the evolutionary hypothesis. I mean, it had massive influence in terms of his thinking and his values. Secondly, well, before I get to the second, Dewey said that Darwinism, the theory of evolution, sets the stage for reconstructing philosophy. If everything has an evolutionary history, then we can understand why it's time for philosophy to evolve to the point that it's a method rather than this vain attempt to come up with intellectualistic answers for reality and what the nature of man is and so forth. Second influence is behaviorism. Dewey believed that what men do is a function of their environment, that condition response mechanisms, as later people would put it, operate so that we are conditioned to behave as we do, and if we want men's behavior to improve, we need to change the conditioning of that behavior, change the environment. And thirdly, Dewey was a humanist, in fact, one of the signers of the Humanist Manifesto. The highest value is humanity, and the final authority is humanity. There will be no supernatural interference in our living, our values, or how we think. So I'd summarize the influences on Dewey as Darwinism, behaviorism, and humanism. If I were to give you a capsule summary of the emphases in Dewey, there would be four in number. I'm doing this, I think you can see my pedagogical style. I try to give you an introductory overview and try to encapsulate it, but then I'm going to pick some main theme out and then go in for more detailed analysis in just a minute. But here at the introductory level, I would say the emphases you remember in terms of Dewey's pragmatism, first, ideas are instruments which lead to action. Ideas are instruments which lead to action. Ideas are not somehow a representative of the objects of the world. Just think of the different versions of ideas or concepts that you've been exposed to just in this course. What does Hegel think of the idea? What does G.E. Moore think of the idea? What does Edmund Husserl think of the idea? Well, over against all of those differences, Dewey said ideas are instruments that lead to action. Secondly, philosophy is problem solving, or as Dr. Bahnsen put it, it's therapy. Philosophy is problem solving. Thirdly, truth is what works, what solves our problems, what gives us success. Now that has been cheapened and popularized, the idea that truth is what works, as a matter of whatever, you know, gets you ahead, whatever gets you money. That wasn't, strictly speaking, Dewey's version of pragmatism. He said men live in an environment where there's complexity and problems and distress, and for the sake of survival, we want to even things out, we want to smooth things out. The truth is what helps us adjust to our environment. He was much more interested in what scientists were doing to experiment. I mean, Dewey would be real proud of how medical science has advanced in its ability to take care of the symptoms of disease, if not to actually cure the disease. And he says it's not important whether we understand all the details of the theory of medicine, so forth, but we're out there and we're getting things done. Pragmatism for him was a lot closer to the model of of medical advance than it was to the greedy businessman saying, hey, it works for me. You know, we suckered those people into buying this and so forth. Fourthly, for Dewey, proof is experimentation. Proof is experimentation. And it's through experimentation that we find what works. And so, in terms of his experimental approach, truth is warranted assertability. You want to have that down as one of the tags in your mind for Dewey's philosophy. Warranted assertability. When asserting something is warranted because of experimental success, you have truth. Warranted assertability. Well, what results do we see from Dewey's philosophy? Well, in American culture in general, I think it'd be no way to bring down the various ways down to a simple summary. This is our cultural outlook. If there is a spirit of the age, to use that Hegelian notion of the zeitgeist, in America, it's Dewey. Dewey, that's the American attitude, is like, I just want to solve the problem, you know? I don't care what you call the weight of the elephant, and I don't care whether it's real. I just want to know whether I'm going to get paid for it. Now, I'm being too crass there, but the American attitude is problem solving. Let's get it done. Can do. And it's seen in so many places, in so many ways, I despair of being able to summarize it. And so number one is simply, this is the American zeitgeist, the spirit of our age. This is distinctively American to approach things from the standpoint of how do we get it accomplished. The can-do attitude, the pragmatic attitude. Secondly, the results of Dewey have been felt more narrowly in the philosophy of education. It's John Dewey that has given progressive education its character and definition in the 20th century. Now, there are other philosophies of education after Dewey, but up until the 1960s, it was Dewey and his outlook on education that dominated the public schools in America. And what can we say about his philosophy of education? First, it emphasizes the spirit of inquiry and experimentation. Education is not a matter of finding the lasting, eternal, or unchanging truth about nature and man. It's rather a spirit of inquiry and experimentation. Secondly, education serves the purpose of individual development rather than any purpose of certain fixed ends or aims. It's not as though we have, if you will, a lifestyle or a certain purpose for everybody that we want to instill in children. It's rather we want them to individually develop. So the spirit of individual development rather than fixed values or ends for everybody. And thirdly, according to Dewey, education is, and I'm going to use an expression here, then explain it, socialization into democracy. Socialization into democracy. Why do you send your kids to school? So they'll learn to be good social creatures. They'll be socialized. I'm not saying socialism here, socialized. That is, they'll learn to interact in society. And particularly, the interaction that should be instilled in children is respect for democratic institutions and processes. You learn to respect the freedoms and opinions of others. You learn not to be a tyrant, not to be dogmatic, not to try to push other people around. And so education is socialization into democracy. Was there a question? Yes? No, far from it. He believed in a democratic leveling effect in society, not an aristocratic. Dewey would be real upset, for instance, with the wealthy prep schools that people send their children to, because they're not learning to be socialized into democracy. They're learning to see themselves as a separate and a privileged class. Okay, well, that's our introduction to Dewey. I want to take a few moments now and do some more detailed work on his theory of knowledge and language, and particularly his view of how we find certainty in this world. As I told you, Dewey called for a complete reconstruction in philosophy. And the effect of this naturalistic reconstruction on the theory of knowledge in particular was most clearly stated in his book, The Quest for Certainty. Dewey here said that knowledge would no longer be understood in terms of theoretical justification, justifying beliefs according to a theory, but rather it will be justified in the context of man's active struggle to adapt to his environment and survive in the face of whatever threatens his life. So let me quote from The Quest for Certainty. Man who lives in a world of hazards is compelled to seek for security. The quest for certainty is a quest for a peace which is assured, an object which is unqualified by risk and the shadow of fear which action casts. If one looks at the history of knowledge, it is plain that at the beginning men tried to know because they had to do so in order to live. In the absence of that organic guidance given by their structure to other animals, man had to find out what he was about, and he could find out only by studying the environment which constituted the means, obstacles, and results of his behavior. The desire for intellectual or cognitive understanding had no meaning except as a means of obtaining greater security as to the issues of action. And that pretty well sums it up. Theory of knowledge should be oriented toward gaining security in terms of our environment, not finding theoretical answers that will justify what we believe. In the beginning, the only reason people ask, how do we know, is because that was a means toward survival. And Dewey says, when you take that means toward survival context away, then philosophy just goes berserko. It's off the track. It's missing the point now. It would be an interesting essay for someone to write comparing or contrasting Dewey's attitude toward risk and Jean-Paul Sartre's attitude toward risk. Sartre says, when you try to get rid of the riskiness of the world, try to get rid of angst, you're living in bad faith. But Sartre says, what's important is that you assert yourself, right? It's the doing that's important. Dewey agrees that the doing is what's important. But according to him, it's for the sake of minimizing risk and gaining security. Well, I'll let you reflect on that. Think among yourselves about these things. And so, according to Dewey, knowledge should be practical, but because practical activity is inherently uncertain and precarious, men have been led to exalt pure intellect above practical affairs in their quest for certainty, a certainty that is unshakable and absolute. So he says, and I quote, thought has been alleged to be a purely inner activity intrinsic to mind alone. That is overly abstract and it's misleading, according to Dewey. Knowledge and intelligence are not determined by abstract thinking or mental justification. They are rather the skills of problem solving, the methods of actively controlling your environment for the sake of security. And so no longer should scholars press for intellectually adequate accounts of their theories of knowledge. Theoretical considerations are irrelevant. And Dewey summarized the pragmatic position in this way: the theory that the processes and materials of knowledge are determined by practical or purposive considerations, that there is no such thing as knowledge determined by exclusively theoretical speculation or abstract intellectual considerations. That's pragmatism. So what counts is not whether one's thinking corresponds to reality. What counts is practical success in adjusting to your environment and resolving the problems there. What counts is gaining security by having control over future change. That is, you are successful when you understand things in such a way that you can control future changes. You're successful when you can build a house where the rain doesn't come in a storm. Okay? You've been able to control the future when you know how to build a good roof. Because now when it rains, there's the uncertainty of your environment, you have security in the storm. That's knowledge. Dewey's reconstruction of philosophy was an attempt to be scientific, but not in the empirical theoretical sense, but scientific in the practical industrial sense, avoiding abstract dead-end questions of past thinkers. Who cares what dead philosophers had to say? Anybody ever heard that attitude? The value of a mental operation is not tested by its accurate reflection of reality, but only by the practical consequences of whether it gives active control to us, enables us to successfully predict things and to make plans for action. And so I'll quote Dewey, "Ideas are anticipatory plans and designs which take effect in concrete reconstructions of antecedent conditions of existence." The first part of that is what you need to capture. Ideas are anticipatory plans. Now, not everything we communicate looks like a plan, but when you analyze it, everything you say is oriented toward an operation in the world. So it amounts to a plan. So if I say, it's raining outside, you might think, well, that's true or false depending on whether it reflects the real world. Dewey would say, it's raining outside amounts to a plan. You can identify that plan in various ways. The plan, it's raining outside, has this cash value. If you're going to go to the car, you'll need an umbrella. Or, if you'd like to get wet all over, step outside right now. It's raining outside implicitly is a plan of action. It's an anticipatory plan. The idea or anticipation of possible outcome must, in order to satisfy the requirements of controlled inquiry, be such as to indicate an operation to be existentially performed. That means in an existing situation. Or one more quote, this one's short enough you can write it down. Ideas have to have their worth tested experimentally. In themselves, they are tentative and provisional. One more time. Ideas have to have their worth tested experimentally. In themselves, they are tentative and provisional. And so, in this light, the pragmatic theory of truth becomes obvious, doesn't it? If a meaningful idea is useful in adjusting to a practical situation, if it helps predict events and control what happens to us, then it's deemed true. And to be successful, I've already warned you of this, but to be successful is not interpreted by Dewey as being personally advantageous. You know, like, I'll be pragmatic. I'll do whatever's in my best interest. That's a real bastardization of a theory of knowledge. We might hold him accountable for being wrong about truth and human nature, and that leads to this bastardization of his ideas, but that was not his idea. For an idea to work means that it predicts certain consequences and gives us active control over our environment. Now, what's interesting about this, if we can put Dewey in his historical setting, is that for Dewey, states of affairs which are antecedent to our inquiry are not the object of knowledge. What do you know when you know something? What's the object of your knowing? Well, it's not anything in the past, not anything antecedent to this inquiry into the world. Now, all other schools of philosophy would have said, yes, when you know something about the world, what is now the case or has been the case. But for Dewey, the object of knowledge has a future orientation. Rather than trying to get a copy of reality and call that the object of knowledge, Dewey said we want to have foresight toward the future, helping us adjust to some environment, whether it's social environment or psychological environment or physical environment. Through scientific experimentation, where we gain control over some environment, we produce the objects of knowledge. Now, this is a radical, and I think ultimately nonsensical, but nevertheless a radical view, that the object of knowledge is created in the process of scientific experimentation and gaining control. Well, we've said enough, well, not enough, but as much as we really can in terms of the time frame of our class, to let you know what Dewey's pragmatism is all about in terms of the flow of historical development, what's distinctive about his view, what's characteristic of it. Now, is this view acceptable? No. I really think that there are problems in it that cannot be surmounted. In the first place, to trivialize what the pragmatists were doing, pragmatism amounts to a recommendation for linguistic renovation, to put it simply. Pragmatism is simply recommending that we change our use of language. We renovate our language. Pragmatism is not helping us understand the problems of philosophy or to solve the problems of philosophy. Pragmatism is just redefining the word true, redefining knowledge. Secondly, the pragmatic orientation to knowledge that says the objects of knowledge are created in the process of experimentation leads to absurd consequences in the theory of knowledge, because a pragmatic understanding of knowledge can be satisfied not by our thinking something that corresponds to reality, copying or representing the world out there, but the pragmatic criterion for knowledge is satisfied as long as we believe that the verifying conditions have been satisfied. As long as we believe the conditions have been satisfied, then it's pragmatically useful, right? Example that I use in a long article that I wrote on Dewey's pragmatism was, let's imagine that I'm contemplating this thought as a truth, that I am in the Rocky Mountains. Now, if I'm in the Rocky Mountains, what plan for action, what consequences might that predict? Well, it would predict that if I go outside, I'll see a bear. Now, let's change this. What if I think that I'm in Australia? What practical consequences might there be for thinking that I'm in Australia? What's the meaning of I am in Australia? Well, part of the meaning is if you go outside, you'll see a kangaroo. Okay? Now then, what if I'm in the Rocky Mountains. No, no. How can I put this? I have to use the old language. What if, in fact, I'm in the Rocky Mountains? But what I believe is that I'm in Australia. So, believing that I'm in Australia amounts to the plan of action that if I go outside, I'll see, what? A kangaroo. Now, if I go outside, and I don't happen to know the difference between a kangaroo and a bear, then I might think, oh, this is a successful plan of action. I did encounter a kangaroo because I thought bears were kangaroos. Now, how can a pragmatist extract himself from that difficulty? I believe that the prediction was fulfilled. And I believe it because I don't know the difference between a kangaroo and a bear. The only way the pragmatist can make sense of their theory of knowledge, that objects of knowledge are created in inquiry, the only way they can escape from, as long as you believe that those conditions were fulfilled, then they're fulfilled, is to say what? You have to test your belief that they were fulfilled against what? A copy of reality. There is a difference between a kangaroo and a bear, and if you don't think so, your life may be shortened. Which doesn't seem very useful to me when all is said and done. Not very pragmatic. So can you really be pragmatic? Can you really be useful in solving your problems and controlling your environment if you don't utilize the traditional understanding of truth and knowledge? Thirdly, by way of critique, I would say that pragmatism has to be convicted of short-sightedness and prejudice. Short-sightedness and prejudice. Why do I say that? Well, because according to the pragmatist, truth is what is useful. Truth is what is useful. Now, any of you should be able to say, well, but that's an incomplete theory. Because the word useful doesn't stand by itself, does it? Useful is always useful for this end. Useful for this rather than that. And so if truth amounts to usefulness in problem solving, pragmatism hasn't really helped us unless it tells us what problems we should solve. Useful for what? Pragmatism is arbitrary in telling us what the end in mind is for the utility or instrumentality of truth. What if somebody has a philosophy of life that says, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die? A lot of people do. Now, if that's your philosophy of life, then it's not going to be useful to go to church, is it? That's not going to help you solve problems. That's not useful for eating, drinking, and being merry, because after all, tomorrow we die, and that's the end of anything. So why bother with religion? Now, somebody could come up with certain socially useful purposes for religion, in which case somebody might say, well, no, religion can still be pragmatic and true in terms of our here and now concerns. But a party animal might not care about, you know, social reconstruction and trying to have a better democratic world and that kind of thing. Eat, drink, and be merry might say, well, that's not useful for me when you talk about religion teaching us to be more democratic and love our neighbors and so forth. And so the pragmatist is going to have to tell us what it is we want to do ultimately. If we want to be instrumentally effective, what do we want our instruments to do? What should we be accomplishing as we live and behave in this world? Because the man who says, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die, lives his life in error if after he dies he gives answer to an almighty personal God. But you see, the pragmatist, wanting to avoid the traditional problems of philosophy, really can't make sense of his pragmatism unless he decides whether God exists or not, whether there is a God you're going to answer to. So what the pragmatist considers useful has to be evaluated according to the end or purpose or aim of the usefulness. And that isn't answered by pragmatism. Or if it's answered, it's answered arbitrarily. One person says, this is what is the sort of thing we should be trying to accomplish. Another person has a different answer. But pragmatism cannot tell you what you should live for or what problems you should be thinking are relevant and to be solved. So let me recap my criticism, and I'm going to have a fourth one here and then we'll be done. First, this is trivial because it amounts to nothing more but a linguistic renovation. Secondly, one need only believe that the verifying conditions have been satisfied unless pragmatists are willing to go back and answer the traditional problems of philosophy of what is true and what is the object of knowledge. Thirdly, pragmatism is short-sighted in its view of usefulness as being the truth, because we have to ask useful for what, and then it's arbitrary for telling us what we're supposed to be doing, what are our problems to be solved. And then the fourth criticism is that there is an internal dialectical tension, a self-contradiction within the philosophy of Dewey that comes out over and over and over again. And I do hope that after this lecture, some of you might want to read my article on this subject. It's entitled Pragmatism, Prejudice, and Presuppositionalism, and you'll find it in the Foundations of Christian Scholarship, edited by Gary North. Pragmatism, Prejudice, and Presuppositionalism. I won't go through it all for you. Time won't allow this. But to boil it down, if you look at the philosophy of Dewey, you get two things going on, and you can't bring the two together. They don't, as we say, comport with each other. On the one hand, he says, science follows invariable norms. Experimentation, as it develops and evolves, lays down invariable norms for how to approach things, how to be successful in getting our questions answered and verifying hypotheses and so forth. So science is at the heart of the pragmatic approach, and science is invariable. There are norms that have to be followed. You all know that. I mean, when you take a course, you know, in lab science, they lay down the procedures and the protocols and things that you need to do. People just don't go out in the laboratory and say, well, I'll do my research this way, and somebody else willy-nilly does it another way. There are norms if you're going to be scientific. That's the one side of Dewey's philosophy. On the other side of Dewey's philosophy is he insists that all experience and all of nature is in flux. All experience and all of nature is in flux. It's constantly changing. It's evolving, developing. Well, now he's got a real problem right in the house of his own philosophy. And see, these two are not going to be married happily, are they? All of experience is in flux, but we need to follow invariant norms in science. Well, is science being true to nature and experience if it insists on unchanging norms? Of course not. You can't have constant change and unchanging rules or values. And this is a great example, I think, of what is the inherent problem of all pagan philosophy. All unbelieving philosophy tries to bring together rationalism and irrationalism. Change and no change. Particular and universal. And it just can't be done. In Dewey's case, he tried to bring together unchanging standards of science or scientific procedure applied to a world which is always changing. Well, then why shouldn't the standards of science always be changing? How can there be invariant principles of experimentation if they are being applied to a world that doesn't show any sign of invariance, but always constant variance or flux and change? So we see the rational-irrational dichotomy within Dewey's philosophy. And thereby see its inadequacy. I'm done with pragmatism. It'd be great if we could have a couple of days to look into all these things. They're fascinating, and especially because of their cultural influence. But we do have to move on. Would you like to ask any final questions about it? Make any remarks? Okay, so realism, phenomenology, existentialism, pragmatism, major develops in the 20th century. We're going to come now in our lecture outline to the last major portion of 20th century philosophy I'll be looking at. I mean, it's impossible to do a history of philosophy and just bring it right up until yesterday. And if we have time at the end of my lecture tomorrow, I'll talk about current trends and names and ideas you might be interested in. But who knows historically what's going to turn out to be the most important, most influential. We come to the last, to the caboose in terms of my presentation of the history of philosophy, and that's logical and linguistic analysis. Logical and linguistic analysis, what is sometimes called the analytical tradition. Logical and linguistic analysis. And as we turn to analytical philosophy,